Today is Monday, September 25th. We're going to be wrapping up the skin chapter by talking about functions. All right, so one of the last things we talked about in class on Wednesday of last week was hypodermis. And I wanted to start by showing you another picture of the hypodermis so you can see how truly deep it is compared to the skin. So looking at this picture, the apical surface of the epithelial tissue is found at the top of this picture. So right out here, this what is a very thin layer of epidermis is going to be our epithelial tissue. The majority of what you're looking at here is a deeper, thicker layer of skin that we call what? Dermis, yeah. And underneath that, we see a fatty tissue layer or loose areolar layer that contains a bunch of fat cells. And so this is our hypodermis down below. So when we talk about, you know, hair being rooted deep into your skin, you can see that those hair shafts and roots actually bury themselves way deep down toward that hypodermis. So that's going to be one of our accessory structures for our discussion today. In addition to hair, what else is considered an accessory feature?
Sweat glands.
Oil glands. And nails. Good. Okay. So let's start by talking about hairs. On the very top line there, you'll notice that hairs are found on all body parts except for which ones? Good. Palms of your hands, soles of your feet, palms and soles. Where else is it not found? Not on the lips. Good. Not on the external genitals. And not on the nipples. Gets really dirty really fast, doesn't it? Okay. So not on the palms, not on the soles, not on the lips, external genitals, nor the nipples. I don't think any baby wants to be breastfed with hairy nipples. You know, there's a certain reason for that, right? So we certainly lack hair in particular parts of the body. This is a really neat picture because what you're looking at is the close-up of a hair bulb or a hair root. And of course, a bulb is the fattened portion of the bottom of the hair. This portion right here is what we think of as the root or the bulb. Notice going around it, it looks like a layer of cells traveling around that hair root or hair bulb and then back up toward the skin surface. That's actually stratum basal, and stratum basal is part of which layer of your skin? Epidermis. Yeah. And so to back it out here, let's get perspective on what we're looking at. You'll notice that this topmost layer in this picture is epidermis. Of that topmost layer, we know the bottom groovy edge is stratum basal. But in the case of a hair follicle, stratum basal actually dives deep into the hypodermis and forms a layer around your hair. We call it now a hair follicle. So stratum basal, in fact, behaves as your hair follicle deep within your skin. The only true way to get rid of hair growth is to kill the hair follicle. All right, so let's think of stratum basal related to the epidermis. What job does stratum basal do for your epidermis? And what's constantly happening there? Mitosis. Yeah, mitosis. Constantly happening in stratum basal. So it makes sense that this actively dividing layer then gives rise to your hairs as a hair follicle. So, the hair follicle is stratum basal. Okay, so on your worksheet, got a question there for you. If the follicle is damaged, what happens to hair growth? That's it, yeah, there's no more hair growth. If you damage stratum basal of the hair follicle, there is no more hair growth. So we probably are all familiar with the effects of shaving. That just simply removes the shaft of hair sticking up above your skin surface. And even plucking your hairs just simply removes the hair from the hair follicle. But the only true way to kill that hair follicle is to do electrolysis, and that damages stratum basal to the point that it can no longer produce hairs. If you pluck enough, though, that can also damage that hair follicle, and then your hair becomes less likely to grow in that particular piece of tissue. Okay, let's see. On your worksheet, it says the portion of your hair within the follicle is called the root. How is hair growth affected if the root is damaged and the hair falls out? So if you damage the root, but the follicle is still intact.
It'll grow back.
Sure will. It'll grow back. And I mean, you're right. It may be more slow the next time, but it'll grow back. So damage the root, the hair falls out, but it will grow back. So we know that hair sticking up above the skin surface is called the shaft. It's made of dead keratinized cells. There is a cuticle that wraps around the outer surface of your hair. And of course, all that stuff is dead, so there's no feeling, no sensation to any of that hair beyond the root. All right, couple more blanks here for you on your worksheet. What is the protein that makes up most of your hair structure?
Keratin.
Keratin, good. Keratin makes up the hair structure. And what about the pigmentation?
Melanin.
Melanin, good. Sounds a lot like skin. You'll notice a term there called the erector pili muscle. What is its job? Good, makes them stand up straight, right? So why in the world do you need your hairs to stand up? Cold or
scared?
Yeah. So I know you've probably seen a cat puff itself up. It blows all of its hairs on end, and it turns sideways and says, look at me, I'm big and scary. Don't mess with me. You know, you don't want to mess with an 8-pound cat, right? So cats can do it. And it's meaningful. It shows you how those hairs can stand on end and make the animal look bigger. We can do it, and it has no effect on, you know, warding off anybody that might be interested in.
It's more funnier than scary.
It's more funny than scary, exactly. So for us, it doesn't have the same effect as cats. So we know that the hairs, when they do stand on end, will trap warmth close to your body. And so when you've got goosebumps when it's cold, or if you're, you know, getting prickly goosebumps for whatever reason, the real goal there is to trap the warmth closer to your skin surface. All right, so I thought I'd show you some different kinds of hairs. This is not on your worksheet. I thought you'd just be interested in seeing this. A lot of the hairs on your bodies, for females, is called vellus hairs. So if you look at the inside of your arm, you'll notice some very tiny, almost transparent hairs there. Those are called vellus hairs. For males, once they reach puberty, about 90% of their hairs are transformed from vellus hairs into terminal hairs. Which one has pigmentation?
Terminal
hairs, yes. Yeah. So males have less of this peach fuzz and more of these terminal pigmented hairs on their bodies. All right, so that's one thing I wanted to share with you. And another thing is about hair structure. The shape or structure of your hair is actually driven by the shape of your hair follicle. If your hair follicle is round, then your hair comes out stick straight. However, if your follicle is more oval shaped, then your hair comes out a little more curly or wavy. And did you know that throughout your lifetime, your hair can change from straight to curly or the other way around? Yep. So kind of an interesting thing there that as you age, genetics may tell your follicles to change shape, and your hair changes structure as well. Let's see, we've got gray hairs in our future. All of us are heading in that direction, some of us quicker than others. I've been gray since I was 23, and that was last year. So some of us do gray faster than others, and what happens is you get these little pockets of air inside your hairs, and those behave totally differently than a pigmented hair. So that's why gray hairs are so unruly. They're actually structured differently inside than a regular pigmented hair. So
obviously, if you pull them out, they'll just grow back faster.
Yep. And you're genetically programmed to make them at a certain age anyway. So, yep. And they say stress helps. I don't know about that, but, you know, it is a genetic thing that you turn gray at a certain age. Let's talk about nails. They are next. Okay, so of course nails are protecting the ends of your fingers and your toes. And they're structured almost identically to the way hairs are structured. So what portion gives rise and allows your hair root to grow? Yeah, so hair root grows from a hair follicle, and a nail root grows from a nail follicle. You got it. And they do call it a bed here. That's right. So they call it a bed. In this picture here, you actually get a look at stratum basal. This is all stratum basal going around this nail. And this stuff starting right here is actually the nail, the cartilage field nail. So again, if you damage the nail bed or the nail follicle, what happens to your nail? It won't grow back. So unfortunately, if you happen to shut your finger in the door just the right way and you kill that follicle, that's it. Yep, so that'll cause that nail to fall out and not grow back. If you just damage the nail root, this portion in here, then you do have a chance for that nail to regrow. I had a student a few years ago, and her grandmother kept having repeated ingrown toenails, and her doctor took all of her nails off. So they actually use silver nitrate. You know, we were talking about turning blue from silver nitrate. Some doctors use silver nitrate to kill the nail follicle and stop the nails from further growing. So I guess she was probably happy with not having ingrown toenails anymore. A student told me her grandmother painted the ends of her toes as if she had nails. Yeah, just painted the skin, yeah. Yep. So I just wanted to mention to you that you may have noticed how rubbery nails can be. They're actually a combination of keratin, that's no surprise, right? And cartilage. Okay. And on your worksheet there, blank for you to fill in, a cuticle is a fold of skin that protects that nail root. Cuticle. So we've got a couple of exocrine glands here to discuss in relation to your skin structure. Exo as a prefix, what does that tell us?
Outside.
Yeah, release it to the outside. And because they are exocrine, we call sweat an excretion. That makes sense because it's exiting your body and ending up on the outside surface. Do you know what type of tissue you're looking at? Yeah, you're right. That's adipose, right? Okay, and these parts here are simple. Good for you, cuboidal. Good. All right, so these tubes that form our sweat glands and oil glands are made up of simple cuboidal. We know they are great for secreting things like sweat and oil, so that kind of goes back full circle to our tissue discussion. All right. So on your worksheet, let's talk about two different types of sweat glands. Sweat glands are often known as sudoriferous glands. I'll tell you how I keep that straight. Do you hear the word odor in sudoriferous?
Yeah.
Okay, so oftentimes we think about sweaty people as odor people, they stink. Okay, there's your connection. So sweat glands are sudoriferous glands. And there's a blank for you to put down. The first one is apocrine or apocrine. Apocrine or apocrine. And the second blank there is eccrine. sweat glands are almost all over your entire body, and they are either considered apocrine or eccrine. And of course, there's a difference here. Which one is associated with hairs?
Apocrine,
good. I'll tell you an easy way to keep it straight. I hear the word ape in there. We know that apes are hairy, right? And those apocrine glands always open into a hair follicle. Okay, so those are in the armpits, the groin. Those are the stinky regions of our bodies, right? Okay, so apocrine or apocrine glands always open into a hair follicle. They tend to become active at puberty. They activate under stress. And their job is not to produce sweat that cools your body down. So kind of interesting that we actually make two different kinds of sweat. We do produce a lot of sweat that will cool us off, but this apocrine sweat is a different kind of sweat. You know, they've done studies to try to figure out why we produce this apocrine sweat. And let's kind of think big picture. If you have a dog, or if you know people with dogs, how do the dogs identify their owners? Where? Their butt.
Oh, wow.
You ever go into somebody's house? What does a dog come do? They come sniff your butt. And you're like, oh, you know, and you kind of feel embarrassed, but that's how they identify you, right? Okay. Thank God we don't do that, you know. Okay, so they've done some studies. They actually had women smell sweaty men's armpit clothes. They had this guy sweating a shirt. They had these women smell their armpit stained shirts. You know, ugh, nasty, right?
Yeah.
You know, pay me some money to do that study. So what they found was women preferred certain odors, and they found that over a long-term time that it helped to regulate women's menstrual cycles. Yeah, so some crazy stuff there. There must be some kind of chemical secreted by these apocrine sweat glands that we're not fully understanding. Yeah, apparently they were smelling, yes, some guys' sweaty armpits, like, you know, undershirts. Yeah. So they don't fully understand what the function is of apocrine sweat glands, but we do know that they're different from the eccrine sweat glands. All right, so which of these two glands is always found in a hair follicle?
Apocrine.
Apocrine, good. And eccrine does not have to be found with a hair follicle. You know, on the palms of your hands, even on your face, the pores on your face are likely those eccrine sweat glands. So, you know, their job is to release sweat, just like on the palms of your hands and everywhere else on your body. And this particular sweat is meant to cool your body down. So typical sweat from an eccrine gland is odorless. It's mostly water, urea, some proteins, electrolytes. But the eccrine sweat is actually odorless. What makes that eccrine sweat smell is bacteria. So what do the bacteria do to that sweat?
They eat your sweat, and then that causes a chemical reaction in them, and that's what causes the stink.
That's exactly right. Good. So those bacteria eat your sweat. They do chemical reactions. They poop on your skin.
Oh, wow.
Yuck. Yeah, and that's where the odor comes from. So certain people excrete different chemicals in their sweat than others. That's why certain people have a different odor and may have a persistent body odor and others do not. It also depends on what you eat. You know, if you have a high-protein diet, you know, the bacteria may love that or may love the foods that you're eating, like garlic or onions. So there's other things in our diet that can contribute to that odor.
You don't
praise your allergy. That is true in so many ways, including your sweat odor, yeah. All right. So we've got apocrine, we've got eccrine, we've got ceruminous glands, which are simply earwax glands. They're modified sweat glands, and we've got mammary glands, which release what?
Milk.
Milk. Good. So those four, eccrine, apocrine, ceruminous, and mammary, are all some type of a sweat gland. And then we've got oil glands. Their fancy name is what?
Sebaceous.
Good. So sebaceous glands produce sebum or oil. They are always, here's your blank, associated with a hair. Always associated with a hair. All right, so what do oil glands do for us?
Moisten,
lubricate, waterproof. Okay, moisten, lubricate, waterproof. And they protect from what?
Protect from bacteria.
Good. Moisten, lubricate, waterproof, and protect from bacteria. Moisten, lubricate, waterproof, and protect from bacteria. Interesting to note that the oil on your skin is acidic, and bacteria don't like to live in those conditions, and so that helps to repel bacterial growth on your skin. What do we turn around and do? We take a bath. We wash our hands. How many places do you see signs posted? Employees must wash their hands, right? You know, we're told wash your hands after this, wash your hands after that, and we wash away protective oils that can keep that bacteria from growing on our skin. So we obviously choose cleanliness over the protective benefits of oils. You know, we wash our hair and our skin frequently and wash away those protective waterproofing oils. All right. So if those oil glands become inflamed, which often occurs with bacterial infections associated with acne, then we may see one of two problems arise. We may see whiteheads or we may see blackheads. The difference is whether or not skin has grown across the surface of that gland. So if skin does cover the gland's opening, we have what's called a whitehead. Yeah. What is the problem with skin covering the opening to that gland? Yeah, that infected or inflamed sebum can't get out. And so what forms inside that gland? Pus. Yeah, so it may need to be drained to get that pus out of that gland. They say that blackheads are, of course, not covered by skin, and they say the coloration comes from dirt and also from melanin in our skin. So that's why it takes on a darker appearance as opposed to a pus-filled whitehead. All right, so how about questions on page 57? Hey, I left for you guys a picture. It's pre-labeled on page 59. You'll notice the letters are by each term. They correspond to the line drawn on the picture. There is a picture like that one. In fact, it's identical to that one on your test. So you'll want to make sure that you feel comfortable with the major features like epidermis, dermis, you know, glands, things of that sort. Everybody get a chance to sign in today. Okay. So how you doing with content today? Everything's clicking okay for you? Okay. All right, let me take you over to page 60. Let's talk about skin functions there. So some of you may be going on to take microbiology, which is Bio 225, or some of you may be taking Bio 115. It's also a micro course. Sometime in your future, you may be taking that for your programs. And in microbiology, they talk about how your skin protects from the surrounding environment, how it keeps you safe from invaders like bacteria and viruses that can come through your skin and harm you from the outside in. So let's talk about some of the protective mechanisms that your skin does for you. All right, so first of all, how many layers overall form your skin?
Two.
Two main layers, good. Which of those layers is keratinized?
Epidermis,
good. And what is the function of that keratin?
Waterproofs
your skin, good. And by waterproofing, it also provides a protective barrier against invasion from things like microbes. So that's a benefit to us, is not only to have multiple layers in your epidermis, but to have those layers keratinized, starting with the outside, you know, all the way down to the deepest layers of your epidermis. All right, something else we just got done talking about. What does oil do for your skin? Good. Moistens, lubricates, waterproofs, and protects from bacteria. Good. So yet another feature of our skin that helps to protect from invasions. Okay. Let's see. We've also got Langerhans cells in the epidermis. What is their function?
Control the epidermis to make sure there ain't no microbes that have gotten to the skin.
Good, good. So if something makes its way into the skin, there's Langerhans cells do patrol, and they can eat and destroy bacteria that have made their way that far into the skin. All right. So this picture shows us some Langerhans cells. This dark layer, you may recall, is stratum granulosum. And it looks like they're primarily down here in stratum what? Spinosum. Yep, looks like they're mostly here in the spinosum region. All right, so another function of your skin is to manufacture and make vitamin D in the presence of what?
Sunlight,
good. How many minutes per day do you need to make your vitamin D?
20.
About 20, yep. What about if you're really dark-skinned?
Is it 10?
It's longer, yeah. If you're dark-skinned, it's longer. If you're lighter-skinned, it's less time. So why, if you're darker-skinned, should you spend more time?
Melanin.
Yeah, your melanin is protective against that UV radiation, exactly. So you actually make a chemical called vitamin D3. It's a hormone called calcitriol. Your kidneys help convert D3 to calcitriol. And calcitriol helps you to regulate calcium and phosphorus metabolism in your bones. So bottom line, we know that vitamin D3 is important for making your bones strong and healthy. Okay, and the link, of course, for us is sunlight. If you don't sit in the sun or if you don't get enough sun exposure every day, what else can you do to get your vitamin D3?
Milk.
Yeah, milk and dairy products, right. So if you're lactose intolerant, you know, you do have options like vitamin D supplements, sunlight. There's still ways to get that vitamin D. You know, there is a crew of scientists that spends the winter in the Antarctic in a complete dark, like a research hut. And I think about them because, you know, if they're spending, say, 6 months in complete darkness, your skin's going to be pale. And what about your bones?
They're
going to be brittle. Yeah, they're going to be less strong than somebody who may have had some sun exposure. And, you know, people sign up to go down there and do that. So, yeah. All right, we also have skin receptors that help tell us about the world around us. Let's talk about the different types of sensory receptors we have in our skin. On your worksheet, you'll notice that we have tactile receptors. They are called Merkel discs and Meissner corpuscles. Okay, and so what they're detecting for us is fine touch, light pressure. Okay, so imagine if, say, somebody laid their hand very gently on your arm. That light touch is going to be picked up by one of these tactile receptors. Or even lighter than that, a mosquito landing on your arm. That type of very light touch or light pressure is detected by these tactile receptors. Another type of receptor found in your skin is called a lamellated receptor, and you'll notice it detects deep pressure. So let's say that you're getting ready to cross the street and somebody notices a car coming really fast that you didn't see. They grab your arm, they grab you hard, and they pull you back onto the curb. That deep kind of grab is going to be like a deep pressure receptor, and you'll notice it's shaped kind of like an onion, isn't it? And if you push down on that receptor, it sends off nerve impulses that tell you, hey, there's some type of deep pressure that I feel here. If you pull a tooth, or if you have deep tooth pain, that's also those lamellated receptors that we feel. And then finally, this is called a Ruffini corpuscle. It helps to detect stretch and tear in the skin. Why is it important that we're aware of potential tears ahead of time?
Because if not, you could tear through your skin even more and cause even more damage.
Cause even more damage. And which portion is less likely to repair?
The dermis,
yeah. So it is certainly important that we know about potential upcoming tears to that dermis. So imagine, you know, skin around your elbow, if it's pulled too tight, around your knee, if you're getting too much pull and tug there, those kinds of tears are going to be detected, hopefully ahead of time, by these Ruffini corpuscles. So in summary, Meissner corpuscles detect light touch. Deep pressure is detected by a lamellated corpuscle. And then finally, Ruffini corpuscles detect distortion, hopefully to prevent the tearing and overstretching of your skin. All right, so which one of these three also detects vibrations? Meissner, good. Meissner's also detect vibrations. So are your ears the only part of your body that can hear vibrations? Your skin can as well. So you don't necessarily hear with your skin.
But you can feel it.
You can feel it, exactly. So if somebody's walking heavily through the house, you feel the vibrations. Those are the Meissner corpuscles. They tell you what's going on in terms of, you know, sound waves going through solid objects before they get to your ears. Okay. How about questions on these three types of sensory receptors in your skin?
These are all just like laying straight in the dermis or the epidermis?
They're somewhat in the dermis. There's even some of these in the epidermis. And depending on how your skin's oriented on your body, I would imagine that most of them are laying pointed up toward the skin to get the most information. Some parts of your body are going to have higher collections of them, and then other parts of your body will actually have very sparse numbers of these. They've actually done two-point discrimination tests, you know, on your arm to see where you have the most receptors and where you have the most feeling, and you've actually got different numbers of these collected pointing, like you say, up toward the skin in different regions of the arm. So they tell moms, if you're testing hot baby's milk, you know, if you're trying to see if it's going to burn the baby, then you actually have more receptors. I believe it's towards your elbow than it is towards your wrist. So, strange stuff. Yep, there's a good picture of them. All right. So tell me, what do tactile or Meissner corpuscles detect? Good. Vibrations, fine touch, very light pressure. What about a lamellated corpuscle?
Deep pressure.
Deep pressure, right. Like somebody grabbing you to pull you back from the street. Okay, and then of course the vibrations we talked about as being housed in those Meissner corpuscles. All right, bottom of your page talks about how our skin contributes to what's called thermoregulation. This is how your skin helps to contribute to the control of body temperature, okay? And we call it thermoregulation. In other words, regulating your body temperature. First things first, you'll notice that normal body temperature is around 98.6 Fahrenheit. That is average. Not all of us are 98.6. Some of us have a normal temp of 97. Some of us are running hot at 99. But we fall within a range, give or take about a degree and a half around that 98.6. On the Fahrenheit scale, that's our number. On the Celsius scale, we run close to 37 degrees Celsius. All right, so let's think back to our skin structure. Does the epidermis contain blood vessels, or is it the dermis?
Dermis,
good. No blood vessels up there in that epidermis. So we're talking about right now blood vessels in the deeper portion called the dermis. These blood vessels in your dermis can be regulating the blood flow to your skin and help us to control body temperature. So what happens to the diameter of a vessel when it dilates?
Stretches,
gets bigger, right? So that the diameter increases and more blood can flow through those vessels. What happens to vessels when they constrict?
Smaller and tighter,
right? So the diameter is, of course, decreased this time, and we have less blood going to the skin surface. If you're hot and you're flushed red, what do you think has happened to your vessels? They've dilated, they've stretched open, right? Why is that? More blood to the skin. Yeah, get the blood up to the skin surface. You radiate off heat, and that helps you to lose heat and to cool down. Okay, so vasodilation is something that accompanies when you're hot. Guess what happens when you're cold? Constriction, yeah. Why is that? Body's cold, body's trying to save the heat. Okay, so instead of letting the heat radiate off your skin, when you're cold, that heat stays toward your vital organs, so it circulates closer toward your deeper organs. Let's talk about erector pili muscles. When do they stand on end?
When you're scared
and when you're cold. Good. What is the advantage of having them stand on end?
Because if you get trapped,
good, they can trap heat close to your skin. Good. So erector pili muscles will stand on end when you're cold. All right, let's talk about shivering. When should you shiver, hot or cold?
Cold.
Cold. Okay, so coldness makes your muscles involuntarily shiver. That produces heat. And of course, the big deal here is sweating, right? Because sweating occurs when you're hot. And that evaporative cooling allows heat to escape from your body. So let's hit the blanks here on your worksheet. Let's hit the cold problem first. When you're cold, sweat glands remain inactive. Muscles start to shiver. Vasoconstriction reduces flow of blood. All right, vasoconstriction reduces flow of blood. Why does cold skin appear blue? Lack of blood, lack of oxygen. Good. Lack of blood and lack of oxygen. And then finally, erector pili muscles stand hairs on end. Trap heat. Yep, that helps us trap heat. Oh, this sounds like a really good essay question. So you may want to put a star beside this one so you make sure to go back and study what happens when you're cold and hot come test time. Let's hit the next one. When you're hot, eccrine sweat glands, there's your blank, eccrine sweat glands activate. Does the simple act of sweating make you cooler?
No, the sweat has to evaporate.
Good. So on a really humid day, we feel awful because the sweat doesn't evaporate. On a dry day, the sweat evaporates, and we feel a lot better when it's dry and we lose that sweat to the environment. What does vasodilation do to blood vessels? Good. Vasodilation increases flow of blood. And we know that when we're hot, we may feel warm to the touch and we may appear reddish in color. Why the red color? Yeah, more blood with more oxygen flowing closer to the surface of your skin. More blood with more oxygen more blood with more oxygen is flowing closer to your skin surface. More blood with more oxygen is flowing closer to your skin surface. So what about heat stroke? What do we stop doing during heat stroke? We stop sweating. That's right. And if you no longer can sweat, what happens to your body temperature? Yeah, you overheat. So with heat stroke, we stop sweating. With heat stroke, we stop sweating and can overheat. With heat stroke, we stop sweating and can overheat. If you get up to 108 degrees Fahrenheit, boy, that's like 10 degrees above what you're normally supposed to be, you can denature your proteins, meaning what? Can't perform vital functions. So those enzymes and proteins in your bodies are permanently changed, and they're unable to go back to the way they were. So we can die with heat stroke with a temperature like 106, 108. All right, so that's a good page of information. A lot of info there. Do you have any questions on that page? So any of you from up north? Okay, so how was your first summer here?
Oh,
awful.
I loved it.
Oh, no, same here. How about any of you? Any of you spent a winter or maybe a vacation somewhere up north?
I wouldn't survive.
How was that winter? Horrible cold.
Well, it felt like it was winter in the lab.
Oh, yeah. So there's a difference in your skin depending on where you live. If you are acclimated to living in a warm environment like the South, then your blood vessels actually are closer to the surface of the skin like you see here, and that helps you to radiate off heat more easily. You know, if you've got a friend that comes south and spends the summer with you, and they say, oh my God, I don't know how you people stand it here, it's so hot, and that's all you hear the whole summer, right? And you're like, what are you talking about? It's just warm today, you know, it's no big deal. And then, you know, maybe the next summer they're complaining a little less, and over time they eventually begin to acclimate. It takes a year's time for your skin to grow vessels in the upper regions if you come from a cold environment to a warm environment like our South. So, likewise, if you go and spend the winter somewhere and having lived here, back to the right picture. Oh, I guess I don't have it.
It wouldn't do the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Start growing up in the upper parts of the skin.
Yeah, and so we got to reduce those vessels and get them down deeper so that we don't freeze to death. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about skin and wound healing. We've done this a little bit already. It's over on the top of page 61. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about wound healing before. We've done it in respect to just generic tissues being damaged. This time we're specific to talking about how skin heals when it's damaged. The first thing that happens when skin is damaged is the inflammatory phase. And inflammation feels awful to us. What are the four cardinal signs of inflammation?
Red, pain, swelling.
Good. Red, hot, pain, and swelling, right? So we know there's tissues like the skin have been inflamed. We experience that. In fact, inflammation is meant to be a healing portion of the phase. It is meant to bring in agents like new white blood cells, fibroblasts, that can start to heal the process. So that kind of involves the second phase, which is migration. We start seeing more white blood cells move into the area. We start seeing more fibroblasts take root. What are the white blood cells there for?
To make sure there's no bacteria escaping into the deep portions of the body.
good. Don't want to get in the deep portions of the body. If you damage as deep as the dermis, what could that bacteria get into? Yeah, bloodstream, exactly. Okay. If you happen to have pus develop during this stage, it doesn't necessarily mean there's infection. It just simply means that there was damage done and those white blood cells have moved in to heal. I think we oftentimes think about pus as being a sign of infection when it's truly a sign of inflammation. It's part of that inflammatory process. What are the fibroblasts here for?
Build
fibers, right? What kinds of fibers?
Collagen.
Yeah, build collagen fibers. Over time, those collagen fibers help to fill in the damaged tissue. This is called the proliferation phase. Notice that scab is shrinking, and eventually the scab is gone, the skin is healed, and what you may be left with is scar tissue. What does scar tissue contain?
Collagen
fibers, yeah. And if you leave scar tissue with collagen in place and you don't further repair this back to its normal setup, what is the problem?
Scar tissue is not as good as regular scar tissue. It's not technically alive anymore. It's just like a replacement.
And you're missing nerves, you're missing sweat glands, you're missing oil glands. So you no longer have the same sensations that you may once have had over that damaged area. People who have keloids or scar tissues that pop up on the surface, that's just collagen fibers that have formed that little, that roughened area, which is no longer going to behave like normal skin. All right. Any questions on those four steps of healing? Let's talk about skin burns. So what are some things that can burn your skin?
Fire.
Hot water. Hot water, fire.
Steam,
acids, the obvious one,
fire.
Sun, yep. Yep, so there's a lot of things that can burn your skin. You know, oftentimes we get kind of tunnel vision and think about just one thing, but yeah, there's a lot of different things that can influence your skin and talk about burns. If we burn our skin and it's a serious burn, then some issues we're concerned about are things like fluid loss. We've now lost our protective covering. We are now introduced to microbes. They say your skin is sterile for about 24 hours after the burn, and then at that point you are ripe for taking by microbes. And then we're looking at cells being killed and protein denaturation. Checking to see if y'all need this slide. Okay. If you've ever heard about somebody being burned severely and they say this person has been burned 30% of the body or 40% of the body, you may wonder how they come up with that estimate. And there's something called the rule of nines that helps us estimate the percentage of your body that is covered by skin. So you'll notice that it breaks down to roughly a 9% setup. The front of each arm, the back of each arm is 4.5%. That totals, 9% for your arms. Each leg on the front is 9%. The back is also 9%. So when they talk about skin coverage, they look at this as a guide to estimate how much burn over the skin surface a person may have experienced. The degree of the burn is also by layer. If you think about the layers here, the epidermis, it's the most superficial region of your skin. If it's burned, that's a first degree. If you burn through the deeper dermis layer, that's the second layer, that's a second degree burn. A third degree burn burns the third deepest layer, that's the hypodermis. And then finally, if you burn down into underlying muscle tissue, that's the fourth deepest layer, and that is a fourth degree burn. So it makes sense when you come up with this scheme. It's just the layer that's been burned and how deep it goes. Okay, so there is no 0 degree, there is no fifth degree burn. It's a first degree through a fourth degree level of burn. Yeah. let's talk about what matters for each of these burns. A first degree burn may be something like a hot water burn, a mild one. It can also be something like a mild sunburn. You experience the signs of inflammation here, red, hot, swelling, you know, heat. Those kinds of things will be experienced from a first degree burn. You know, a first degree sunburn is going to feel no different from a first degree hot water burn. And so the signs are the same, basically the red, hot, swollen, and painful skin. What feature distinguishes a second degree burn from a first degree burn?
Blisters,
right. These blisters may take 2 to 3 weeks to heal. And unfortunately,
don't bust them.
Yep, because then you've got what? Yeah, pain and infection. Yep, so that's the caution there with a second degree burn. So to differentiate, first degrees do not have blisters. Second degree does have blisters.
Don't we also say second degree?
It is the most painful, yeah, because you've still got nerve endings that can sense all that inflammation. So lots of blisters here. All right, so in this picture, we've got third degree burns, specifically in the areas that have been pretty much charred white, these regions through here. And those particular regions that have third degree burns, are they very painful or painless?
Painless.
Nerves are dead. So go back to this picture. Third degrees burn down into the subcutaneous fat, and that means that you've burned all those sensory nerve endings in the dermis and the epidermis. So there's no sensation carried out there in that third degree burn. That's unfortunate.
So what if you get like really, really fried in the sun and your, for instance, chest gets blistered all over? Would it then be
second degree? Okay. Yep. Okay. Third degree burns can also make the skin look charred, like you see in this picture. And assuming that it's third degree, we're going to say that it goes down to what layer?
Hypodermis,
yeah. And of course, a skin graft is needed here because you've killed all possibility of regrowing any epidermis or dermis. Really, it just looks like it caught on fire. And fourth degrees actually go the deepest. They go beyond epidermis, dermis, hypodermis, and they go down into the muscle tissue. And so you can see the skin looks like it's just completely been cooked off this hand. This, by the way, was a hot water burn, so it damaged all the way to the muscle tissue underneath. Yeah, I don't know what kind of hot water that was, but yeah, that's pretty severe. I've got a video to show you all. It's called Skin Gun, and I want you to be able to hear it. So let me switch computers real quick.
Like something you'd see in Star Wars.
This is Matt Euro.
state police officer from Pennsylvania. He's one of the first people to be treated with the gun.
I attended a July 5th party at a friend's house, and there was a small bonfire. I was standing next to the bonfire, and an individual decided to throw a cup of gasoline on the fire. The worst part was my face. It was the whole right side of my face, hair, my ear, my neck, and my shoulder, and the entire top part of my arm.
Urim had suffered severe second-degree burns. This photo shows what a second-degree burn looks like.
The arm kind of looked like a piece of charred meat. I thought it was left on the grill too long. The doctor said that I might be a candidate for this new procedure, which is a spray gun, and asked me if I'd be interested.
Skin cell spraying is like paint spraying. Just, you need a more sophisticated device, like computer control. We isolate cells from the healthy part of the skin, the patient's own cells, which can be taken in a water solution, and that solution is prepared for cell spraying.
Basically, what they were doing was taking my stem cells from my skin and putting them all in a gun and spraying it on my arm.
Scientists have been able to regenerate sheets of skin for decades. The problem is it takes weeks for that skin to grow, and the new skin is extremely fragile. Gerlach's gun solves both of these problems.
It takes like 1.5 hour to take the biopsy, to isolate the cells, and to spray the cells.
This is what Urim's skin probably looked like before treatment. This is what it looked like 4 days after it was sprayed with his own stem cells.
They did it on a Friday, and my follow-up was that Monday, and Bernie had said it was healed.
Though the skin gun is still experimental, over a dozen patients have already been successfully treated.
Wow, that's amazing. So if you didn't get to hear the whole thing, the link is actually in our course in the PowerPoint. If you'd like to go back and look at it. So, do you know how old that video is? 2011.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, what's really interesting is I was looking to see if they had any updates on it, and people have been asking, people have seen this video, and they've been asking about updates, and they said that there's a private company that's testing that skin gun and trying to get FDA approval to get it used, and then hopefully once that happens, after clinical trials and everything, they can make this a more mainstream way to repair skin damage. They said that, you know, he said that he had been burned on Friday night, and he was released from the hospital 4 days later. And you saw how his skin looked, it looked like pretty brand new. Mm-hmm. They said in reality, it takes about 4 days to re-epithelialize the skin, and then about 2 weeks to fully grow back to a fairly good thickness, which is not a surprise, right? Because it takes about 2 to 4 weeks to fully grow a new set of skin cells from stratum basal. So when they sent him home, his skin was probably fairly fragile and not completely strong back like it would be originally. But, I mean, gosh, given the cons of having the skin scarring and stuff, I'm sure he's very pleased with the outcome of that. They said that all they need to do is take about a postage stamp size bit of your skin, and then that's what they extract those stem cells from. I don't know if you heard the guy say it takes about 1.5 hours to extract your stem cells. So I think they need to fast track that for people who've got severe burns. Yeah. And they can take that from somewhere else and then spray that back on that part that's been damaged. Yep. All right. So last little bit here for us is on page 62. So let's talk about skin cancer, which is a very common type of cancer. Skin cancer has its roots in DNA in our cells changing. So if the DNA changes, then the cells may no longer listen to what's being told to them in terms of divide or rest. And so the cells may divide just in rapid succession, causing cancer or tumors. Benign cancer is different from malignant cancer, which is the better news.
Benign.
Because it is?
Malignant.
It's localized. Yeah, benign tumors are localized. What has happened to malignant tumors?
It's all over.
It's all over. It's spread, right. So another word for a malignant tumor is one that has metastasized. And a lot of these cancer names end in omas. Carcinomas are those that affect epithelial tissues like skin. Adenocarcinomas affect glands. Even salivary glands can develop, say, cancer. What do sarcomas affect? Bone and muscles. How about lymphomas?
Lymph nodes.
Lymph nodes and leukemias are?
Blood
cells, right. So interesting to note that the most common cancers here are epithelial in nature. What is it about epithelial tissue that promotes the higher cancer rates? It's exposed to stuff, yeah, that's part of it. And what happens if it's damaged? How quickly can it regrow? Right, so compared to other tissues, like say a connective tissue or a muscle tissue, epithelials grow pretty fast. So that fast growth and repair rate combined with exposure to things that can promote cancer give us a higher cancer incidence in some of these tissues. So lung cancer, prostate, colon and rectal cancer, pancreatic cancer, these are all epithelial in nature. Even bladder cancer, esophageal cancer, we know leukemia is not epithelial, we know that's blood cancer. But a lot of these things, you know, even for women, ovary, uterus cancer, breast cancer, these are all epithelial tissue problems that have gone awry. So in terms of the risk of developing cancers, wow, for women it's like a 1 in 3 chance. Breast cancer is our highest chance of developing cancer. And for men it's a 1 in 2 chance. And prostate cancer happens to be the highest risk for men. All right. And so, you know, the interesting thing to note here is the survival rates for cancers are actually tied to diagnosis and detection. The ones that have the lowest rates for survival are ones that have the lowest chances of being detected. So people with prostate cancer, of course, you know, have a very good chance of having it, you know, removed, having it killed, you know, that tissue removed from their bodies and being able to survive. But why not pancreatic cancer? Not detected, right? People don't know they've got it until it's malignant and then spread elsewhere. So that's the unfortunate thing about some of these cancer types. Let's kind of focus our discussion now on talking about skin-related cancers. First of all, what does carcinoma mean? It is a skin cancer. And because it's a basal cell carcinoma, what particular layer of the epidermis is affected? Stratum basal, right? Okay. So what activity occurs in stratum basal? Mitosis. Yeah. Constantly dividing cells, mitosis. And in this picture, this topmost brighter pink stuff is actually all of our epidermis. So the rest of this picture is supposed to be dermis. But do you notice the tumors here? That's a tumor. That's another tumor. Here's another and another. So you can see that this is actually pushed down into the dermis of the skin. So instead of making a visible outcropping there, it's actually invaded the dermis. Okay. So when they perform surgery on something like basal cell carcinoma and try to remove it, they're scraping like you would for a bad spot on an apple. they'll take and they'll make a cut here. They'll look at it under a microscope to see if there's cancer cells. If there are cancer cells, they cut deeper. They check again on the pathologist, you know, looks at it under a microscope. They keep cutting until they get all clean edges. And when they get all clean edges, no more cancer cells, they feel fairly confident patching this up. So this is actually a fairly common type of cancer. It is least likely to metastasize, meaning what?
It means it's less likely to spread.
Less likely to spread, right. How would you know that you've got basal cell carcinoma? Older people have it more commonly than younger, so age is certainly an issue there. And if you happen to have a sore or a wound that will not heal, you know, it bleeds, it scabs, it bleeds, it scabs for weeks on end, that is a warning sign for basal cell carcinoma. And if left untreated, like these cases, get worse and worse. And then take a look at these here. This affects this entire person's face.
Oh,
yeah. So, you know, sometimes people just say, oh, it's okay, I just, you know, nicked myself, and they don't realize it's been happening for weeks of bleeding. That's certainly something to have checked.
What location is that?
Forehead.
Forehead, yeah, because there's the two eyes.
I couldn't tell on the forehead.
Yeah, it's quite an invasive one here. Squamous cell carcinoma affects the keratinocytes. Okay, and they make up the majority of our skin. And they, of course, you know, this can also be treated. It's very visible. People know they've got it. If they can cut it away and remove it, then it prevents metastasis to other locations. And a lot of these just simply look like they don't belong to you. You know, this doesn't look like something that should be on your skin. Yeah. And of course, if left untreated, they can become larger and spread and invade other tissues. The one to be concerned about, though, is the melanoma skin cancer. It is the one most likely to metastasize, and it can kill people. It also comes from being exposed to sun or UV radiation as through tanning beds. Instead of reading the ABCDE rule to you, I'm going to show you some pictures. What they say is to get naked, look in your mirror at least once a year. And if you can't see very well, then have somebody else do the checking out for you. And they say, look for the ugly ducklings. These are ones that have, these are moles or freckles that don't look like the rest of the ones on your body. So the first thing we're looking for is asymmetry, two sides that don't match, like this one up top. We also look for B, border, which means that the border should be regular, not jagged like this one. C is for what?
Color.
Okay, let's see if we can find one. This one's two-tone, right? That's a warning sign. Sometimes it's blue, black, brown, yellow, odd colors mixed in there. So color is a third warning sign. Let's see. D is diameter. Let's get you some big ones. That's a pretty large one down there on the neck. Larger than a pencil eraser. That's about the tip of your pinky finger. That's pretty darn big, isn't it? Okay, so 6 millimeters or larger is a warning sign, and E enlarging is another. Okay, and your parting thought for today, not all skin surfaces, that's a penis, have to be sun exposed. These are gums. Yeah, so, you know, don't dismiss it just because it's on an area of the body that not normally gets sun exposure. Could be anywhere, sure could. Hey, we'll pick up with bones on Wednesday.